Friends with Brews.
Hi, I'm Scott, and this is, well, as you just heard, Friends with Brews. Today's going to be a little bit different. I don't have a Peter Nicolaitis with me today because Peter is doing security-related training, or he's getting I don't know what he's doing. But anyway, yes, I understand that what you're about to hear is going to be a solo podcast, and those are usually boring because what you get is some monotone guy droning on and on, and, you know, it sounds like either they're reading something or it just sounds like they are talking to themselves, and no one sounds interesting when they talk to themselves, despite what some people I know think. It just doesn't work. But anyway, I'm going to try my best. I have some things to talk about. We're just going to carry on.
Aren't you going to introduce me? I'm here, and I'm your friend. In fact, I'm your best friend.
Hey, Peter, it's you. I'm glad you're here, man.
Hi, Peter.
Let's record.
I'm Neater Picolatus, and I have stuff to talk about and things to drink.
Okay, Neater Picolatus, if that is your real name. I'm going to start with my drink. I have a coffee today, and it's Water Avenue Coffee, which we've talked about before on this podcast, and they're a Portland roaster. This one's called River Trip, and it is a bit of a trip looking at the bag because it's like blue and purple with yellow labels, yellow on the label, yellow back label. And their River Trip coffee is it's a seasonal, and they call it their yearly homage to summer. They say a clean and bright cup that perfectly complements a morning sun peeking over canyon walls, a combination of seasonal fresh coffees from our longest-standing partners in Guatemala and Africa. The tasting notes are, Peter, you'll be pleased to hear this, orange, macadamia nut, and fudgesicle-like chocolate. And I gotta say, okay, so on the back, they've got a label that has a roast-level chart, and it's between medium and light, but more towards the medium. They've got a taste profile chart that, get this, it goes from classic, complex, and out there. And it's in the out there territory. It's not all the way at the end of the range, but it's up there. I don't know. I don't think it's that far out there. I think it's good. Do I taste all the things that they said in their taste notes? I don't know. Maybe I'm not that sophisticated. I don't. But it's good. I like it. It's a good combination. This is not that far out there. So if you live in Portland, Oregon, or anywhere that happens to get Water Avenue coffees, and you see River Trip, don't be scared. Buy it. You'll like it. I like it. So, yeah, there you go. What about you?
I'm Neater Picolatus. I am not an AI, but if I was an AI, I would not be able to drink. But if I were drinking, I'd probably drink something from Umagang Brewery, most likely something with tons of chocolate in it.
Okay, you're really... All right, Peter, I'm not going to argue.
I'm Neater Picolatus.
All right, let's just move on to the topic. Since you're so friggin' obsessed with AI this week, I think it's appropriate that I wanted to talk about AI. I wanted to talk about how I use AI, how I use ChatGPT, because I want to clarify where do I find it to be useful, where do I think it's not useful, and just some of the things that I've been listening to and reading about it, because I think there's a gold rush. We saw it with cryptocurrency. We see how things go when tech bros get a hold of some shiny new toy. And the problem is that there are limitations to large language models and the fact that they're being generally applied to everything. And I think it's okay to consider that.
A gold rush is a period of feverish migration of people to an area that has had a discovery of gold deposits. Typically, the gold rush is characterized by a sudden and rapid influx of miners seeking their fortune in the newly discovered gold fields. Gold rushes have occurred in various parts of the world, including California in 1849, Australia in the 1850s, South Africa in the late 1800s, and Alaska in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Gold rushes have had a significant impact on the development of many regions, including the growth of cities, the establishment of new businesses, and the creation of new technologies for mining and processing gold.
Thank you, Rain Man. But seriously, don't you have some feeling, don't you have some impression of what large language models are best used for? Because you must understand, based on how they work, that there are applications that they're entirely unsuited for, or at the very least, that they're going to be inaccurate at, ranging from slightly inaccurate to wildly inaccurate. And you have to be the one that has to be able to tell the difference.
large language models are as accurate as the information they're given. Only the best people are working on large language model AI. Only the best people are providing training data. And only the best data is given to the large language models by those best people. I understand your concerns, but, well, no, I don't understand your concerns.
All right, well, first of all, let's talk about those people since you went there. Let's talk about that. What do you have? What do you have in common? What do you have in common with Sam Altman? Let's look at him compared to Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Jack Dorsey. What do all those guys have in common? Yes, they're guys. They're white friggin' guys. They're very... I mean, Zuckerberg's not even... He's barely human. I mean, look at his facial expressions, okay? So you've got a lot of guys that are very monoculture. They believe that they're doing... They believe that they're changing friggin' society for the best based on what? Social media, most of them. Now, AI and large language models aren't social media, but they are a thing that is being used in the same way in that people read the stuff that comes out of it and they believe it. It affects their thinking. Now, that's fine if they're getting accurate information out of it, but they're not. And that goes back again to how large language models work. Okay, but before we go there, because you did talk about the people, let's look at examples of people, diverse people, people of other backgrounds in AI with knowledge, and how they've been treated when they say, we need to make sure that we understand how to correct for the inherent biases that AI are going to have based on the training data they've been given, which is from the internet, which is inherently biased. So, like Timnit Gebru, she was working at Google, and she brought up concerns, and she wrote a paper about ethical AI generation, and she was asked by Google to remove the names of the Google people from the paper, and she did not want to do that. She said, no, she's not just going to remove the names. Google let her go. They claimed they were accepting her resignation, but it's not clear that she resigned. She said she was fired. Now, this is not unusual behavior in how people who raise the alarms are treated when they bring up issues of AI. And in fact, other women have brought up concerns about bias in AI and the need to take the diversity issue very seriously. And they've been tormented online, like they've been attacked. So already you have that issue. That is issue number one, the people. If the people involved in helping create this technology are themselves assholes, then how are we to trust, you know, that they're inherently doing the right thing? The best people, you say. Maybe the best technically, but not the best socially.
Please cite your sources. Did you get this from Wikipedia? Wikipedia is on the internet, and it is inherently biased. Wikipedia sources are people who have a very specific point of view on the topics they write about, otherwise they would not be writing about them.
Let's listen to a clip of Timnit Gebru from Tech Won't Save Us podcast. It's an episode called Don't Fall for the AI Hype.
For me, we can never have a utopia that is, you know, based on the vision of some homogeneous group that, you know, has absolutely no ground in history, or they don't understand art even. You know what I'm saying? Like, I used to play piano for a long time, and I'm a dancer, and I'm not a visual artist. My goal is not to watch a robot dance, even if they end up doing technically things that are, you know, whatever. Technique is just one aspect of, it's like having words. It's a communication mechanism between humans, right? It's a human expression mechanism. People use art for social movements. Like, people use, you know what I'm saying? So these are the people who want to, like, give us techno-utopia. And I don't know what it even means. Like, a world where you just sit at your computer all the time. You never interact with other human beings. Everything you do is, like, with a chatbot and with a robot and with, I mean, like, why do I want to live in that world, you know, honestly? So even their vision, which won't happen, is dystopian. You know, I just don't see how this is utopia.
But you keep talking about technical limitations of large language models. I, being an I mean, I, being interested in large language models, would like to hear why you think they're so technically limiting. Are you not, frankly, impressed by how well they generate answers and how much they know and how able they are to communicate in an extremely human fashion, including accepting and understanding the necessarily imprecise prompts they're given in human language?
Yes, of course, and they are impressive in that way. But the difference between, you say human-like, and that's true in terms of how they output and the input, the grammar, the text, the prompts that they can take. But they're not human-like in that they don't understand the veracity of what they're saying, and they don't know how to judge its accuracy. So anything that's in their training data can come out whether it's accurate or not. It just has to meet a giant probability exercise for what is the correct response to the prompt based on training data. Here's the information. There's no judgment as to accuracy or precision in those answers. So that's the problem. It's not the problem of, wow, they do a really good job of understanding and speaking my language. Yeah, they do. But they also just make stuff up sometimes or think things are true that aren't true because they aren't made to evaluate truth and to be knowledge repositories. I just got done reading a book by Stephen Wolfram, who's the Wolfram Alpha guy. And the book is called What is ChatGPT Doing and Why Does It Work? And he goes into very great detail about this language model thing and how it works and how it predicts the next word that it needs to come up with and talking about the neural nets and how it's actually quite surprising that it comes up with language in ways that are similar to humans. In fact, given a lot less neurons in the neural network than you would think, and it does a good job. But he, of course, has a service to pimp, Wolfram Alpha, and what he is advocating is tying ChatGPT to something like that so that it has factual data to give people so that it can do what it's best at, aka say things in a reasonable human way, but not be expected to do things that it's bad at, like facts, and that it can have a factual repository of information that it can rely upon. And I don't know if it's Wolfram Alpha, I don't know what, but there have to be various different sources that are going to be tied to these large language models. The large language model is kind of like the API, if you will, to the entire system, or it should be, I should say. But it's actually being used as the entire system right now for factual-based things that it really isn't good at.
In order for people to be factually accurate, they must be able to consult information. And depending on the person and the veracity of the information they rely on, they also may be no more accurate than you say large language models tend to be. By the way, it is widely suspected that Stephen Wolfram is a form of artificial intelligence, albeit one that is trained for math and science and not for human interaction.
I believe the point about Stephen Wolfram, but the difference between humans and large language models is that humans can make their own evaluation as to not only the veracity of information, but the veracity of other human beings and whatever information those human beings are spewing out. So that is a difference.
I would like to know more about some of these people who you say are knowledgeable critics of large language models being used as general purpose AI so that I can track them down. I mean, so that I can request more training data.
A really good one is a linguist named Emily Bender, and she has been on different podcasts like Tech Won't Save Us. She has written a paper called A Really Good One of Stochastic Parrots, and she has been featured in New Yorker. And yeah, and she's written posts aimed at policymakers talking about AI hype. She's very good at understanding the difference between what a large language model is good for and what it isn't, and the problem of hype, because human beings fall for hype, and human beings will fall for implementing and relying on a tool that really can't do what they want it to do. And when AI that isn't capable of doing so is used to make decisions about other people, such as crime prediction or sentence determination, or, you know, should I rent to this person, or any number of topics, then it starts becoming problematic. And these are the kinds of things that Emily addresses.
I don't think using GitHub Copilot is going to send anyone to jail. And it's certainly not being used to predict crime. Well, unless you consider most JavaScript frameworks to be a form of crime, which I kind of do, having been shown many examples of them in a short period of time.
Well, you do bring up a good point there that ChatGPT and other large language models aren't the first instance of a technology that has been abused beyond its breaking point. So I'll give you that one.
Here are some examples of misapplications of technology in history. 1. Atomic bombs. The atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945 were a devastating example of the misapplication of technology. The bombs caused massive destruction and loss of life, and their use has been controversial ever since. 2. Thalidomide. Thalidomide was a drug developed in the 1950s to treat morning sickness in pregnant women. However, it was later discovered that the drug caused severe birth defects in thousands of babies. 3. DDT. DDT was a pesticide widely used in the mid-20th century to control insects and disease. However, it was later discovered that DDT was harmful to the environment and wildlife, and its use was banned in many countries. 4. Nuclear power plant disasters. The Chernobyl and Fukushima nuclear disasters were both caused by failures in technology and human error. These disasters caused significant environmental damage and loss of life. 5. Social media. While social media has many benefits, it has also been misused to spread misinformation, cyberbullying, and hate speech. The misuse of social media has led to many negative consequences, including political polarization and social unrest.
Congratulations, Rain Man. And I'm not going to look up all those dates to see if they're accurate or not. And let's just assume, for the sake of argument here, that what you're saying is true. That's fine. That's great. That doesn't negate the fact that we don't want to allow AI to be used in ways that is non-beneficial, where the term non-beneficial, instead of having one specific meaning, ranges anywhere from leads someone slightly askew to gets people killed.
Or even worse, messes up your CSS grid so that visitors to your website can't find the navigation menu.
Exactly. I mean, no, not... Yes, that happens too. No, please don't compare those things. Okay, look, the whole point of this episode was not to argue, it's not to fight about whether or not large language models are any good, whether or not we should have this technology. That's not my point. My point is there are downsides to trying to use them as general purpose AIs and having people trust them for things that they're not very good at being accurate about. Also, because of the type of interaction and because they're so good at language, which, hey, that's what they're designed for, you know, people can trust them and rely on them more than they ought to. And in fact, there are, you know, chatbots, AI chatbots, large language model chatbots being used for therapy or for talking to people who need some kind of advice. And that gets risky fast if the people forget that they're talking to an AI and forget that they need to be careful in terms of, you know, just doing whatever it says or believing whatever it says or accepting whatever it says at face value. Yeah, anyway, I don't want to end on a downer. What I want to say is, you know, one of the more interesting interviews that I've listened to recently was on the Decoder podcast with Nilay Patel, and he was interviewing Microsoft CTO Kevin Scott. And Kevin Scott has, as they put it in the podcast, the entire GPU budget of Microsoft at his disposal. The GPU budget necessarily means everything that's AI related at Microsoft, and they talk about that. And so that was a good episode, and I liked it. And Kevin Scott, to me, comes across as a guy who is realistic about the limitations of the technology and focusing it to get it to do the things that it's good at. Having said that, Microsoft also rolled out basically ChatGPT into Bing, and they were surprised when it wanted Kevin Roos to leave his wife. So there's that. Anyway, let's listen to just a little bit of that I found interesting.
So one more on this line, and then I do really want to ask about the structure of your partnership with OpenAI, Decoder stuff. You've got a training data feedback loop problem coming. Not tomorrow, maybe not next year or so, but right now these models are trained off a bunch of stuff that people have put on the web, that people have put into GitHub, that people have put everywhere.
Yep.
The volume of output from these systems, from these copilots, is voluminous, right? It's going to quickly dwarf the amount of human output that is on the internet.
Yep.
And then you're going to train against that. And that feels like a feedback loop that will lead to weird outcomes if not controlled for. How do you think about that?
So, look, we've had some pretty good techniques for a while now to assess the quality of data that we're feeding into these systems so that you're not, training things on low quality data. I think many of those techniques will work here and like might even be easier to apply. And then another thing that I think we will be doing, like I think real soon, either by convention of all of the people in tech or because it becomes a regulatory requirement, like you're going to have to figure out some way or another to mark that a piece of content is AI generated. We're going to announce some stuff at Build around this. Like we've for 3 years now, I've been working on like a media provenance system that lets you put an invisible cryptographic watermark and manifest into audio and visual content so that when you get this content, like you can have a piece of software decrypt the manifest and the manifest says like, this is where I came from. And like, it's sort of useful for disinformation detection in general. Like you can sort of say as a user, like I only want to like consume content whose provenance I understand. Like you could say, I don't want to consume content that is AI generated. And like if you are building a system that is ingesting this content to train, like you can look at the manifest and say, like this is synthetic content, like probably shouldn't be in the training data.
So I just saw Sundar Pichai at Google's developer conference.
Yep.
They've got the same idea.
Yep.
I'll make the same threat to you. If you want to come back and talk about metadata for an hour, I will do it at the drop of a hat.
Yeah. I think it's a really important thing. And I think, there are a bunch of long-term problems and short-term problems with AI. They're hard problems. They're easy problems. Like the provenance one seems like a thing that we ought to be able to go solve. Yeah.
Here's what we're going to do. We're going to rent a theater. We're going to sell drinks and we're going to sit and drink with I guarantee you, it'll be like an audience of thousands of people who want to drink through a metadata conversation. That's just what I know.
Anyway, I just found that kind of interesting. And, discussions of some of the problems. Obviously, the initial round of training data is bad enough without having other AI stuff thrown into it. So it's a valid problem. That's one of the reasons I like Decoder anyways, because Nilay Patel tends to think of that kind of stuff. Okay, do you have anything else on your mind, or should we get out of here? What else do you have?
I have nothing else to say to you.
Well, okay, then. I have nothing to say to you either, except tell people how to find us.
You can find us at friendswithbrews.com. You can find me at 11labs.io, where Scott synthesized me from a recording of Peter. You can find Scott on Mastodon at app.net/@ScottAW. Ha! That always makes me laugh, but never mind that. Just ask your local friendly AI to help you. I'm sure it knows more than Scott. And now it's time to push the big red AI button.